Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition, family and friends edition. On top of that, because today, just now, he just left, I sat down with my oldest friend, everyone. My oldest friend is not from 6 and 7 years old. My oldest friend is from about the ninth grade, Jim Issa. We met in the ninth grade. We talked a little bit about this at the beginning, had a bunch of classes together in the 10th grade. And that's when we really became rock-solid pals. And Jim and I, he kind of helped me kickstart my broadcasting career because we had a little radio show in high school. And that was kind of the first time I ever did anything like this on a microphone. It was with him, and he was my first creative partner, 30-something years ago, which is crazy, and that makes us super old. But Jim came in here to talk about Rushmore. After debating about various films like Almost Famous and Singing in the Rain and Barton Fink and some other good films, he settled on that. Jim lives down the street from me now. It's kind of cool. We live in the same neighborhood. Jim is the drummer in our old man band, El Cheapo, and he is a director. He works in advertising now and directs a lot of television commercials, but he has directed a feature film called Good Intentions and was the founder of a very influential improv group in Atlanta many years ago called the Whole World Theater, which is still going strong, and made his career as an actor for a while and as an editor for a while. And Jim is just a super talented guy and really one of my brothers in life. And so it was a long time coming, but it was great to get Jim in here, someone I really think a lot of and his opinion and thoughts on art and culture and stuff like that. And it's just always fun to sit down with my old pal. Let's be honest. So that's what we did, and we talked about Rushmore, the second film from the great, great Wes Anderson, a movie we both adore, and it was a lot of fun. And also, by the way, there was a little bit – we had a little bit of microphone crackle going on near the beginning, and we decided rather than trying to recreate the magic of the first 10 minutes of a podcast, which is never a good idea, we decided to just clean it up as best we could, and then we fixed the problem from there on out. So sorry about that. But I hope you can forgive us. So here we go with Jim Issa on Rushmore. How you doing?
I'm good. It's
good. My oldest friend.
I know. Ninth grade?
Yeah, ninth grade. I was thinking about this the other day. We definitely met in ninth grade, mm-hmm. but 10th grade was that year where we had like 4 classes out of 6 together or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe even 5.
Yeah.
And that was where it was, things got really silly.
I remember the class, and I remember, I just don't remember the teachers were in 10th grade. It's like.
Well, the only thing I remember was Miss Karn Geometry.
Yeah.
Which was tough. And we were in that class together.
Yeah.
And a couple of others. I just can't remember what. But for those of you listening, Jim was president of student council, and I was vice president. And you ran unopposed, didn't
you? I did, yeah.
Good for you.
Thank you.
I never aspired for that position at all. So I ran against my prom date. Remember Heather Zarrett?
Yeah, and you won. I mean, Heather Zarrett's great. But
she's great.
We had our high school career, like – our senior year was, I mean, well, it started at, what did we started a radio show. I mean, that was your idea.
Well, yeah, that's part two is, was that my idea?
Yeah, because I was, so the president of the student council would do the daily announcements.
Right.
And you were on the newspaper staff.
Right.
And I wasn't smart enough to get on the newspaper staff.
Junior year you were not on, right?
I was not on,
but you were senior year.
Because you talked Mrs.
Lancaster
into getting me on the
really?
Newspaper staff. Yeah, and said, we're going to do a radio show instead of Jim doing the daily announcements.
Right.
So W-R-H-S. My powerful position in your brains brought the first read-in WRHS show.
Which was every day, instead of the announcements, we would do just like this, 6-minute The announcements were included,
yes.
But we would do comedy bits, and it was really – I don't think anyone ever listened.
Yeah, of course they did. They all – yes.
Well, because, I mean, they had to, but yeah. I literally don't remember one person ever coming up and being like, you guys do a great job.
No. Well, remember the It's Friday thing we do every
yeah.
day? It's Friday.
Uh-huh.
People would do that to me. And okay. even afterwards, I think Joey Wong or whoever took over that position
right.
attempted the It's Friday
really?
Fanfare thing.
Just didn't work
just
out.
Just didn't have it. Well, we had the relationship with Miss Abercrombie.
Oh, yeah.
The assistant vice principal uh-huh. or the vice principal.
She was over there in the front office, right?
Yeah. I remember calling her the mistress of the dark.
That's right.
And then there was the picture of the celebrity
sure.
football player.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy. At the risk of a trip down memory lane, I think we should talk a little bit more about what's most interesting about you. Well, not what's most interesting, but like you're a director, and I haven't had a lot of directors in here. Actually, let me jump back. Before that, let's talk about Whole World.
Okay.
Because Jim was one of – were you one of the founders?
Yeah. There was a few of us, the founding members.
Okay.
So it started off with a guy named David Webster coming to Atlanta – and teaching a workshop. And
right. This is improv
yeah.
theater.
And this is in 94.
Yep. Kind of before. I mean, of course, improv was going on, but it's not like now, I feel like.
Yeah.
Where there's just so much of that stuff.
Yeah. So it started off as just like a workshop. And then this guy's like, hey, I'm thinking about moving to Atlanta. And I'm like, oh, I'll tell my theater class about it. And we.
Because you were an actor studying at Georgia State Film.
Mm-hmm.
But were you taking like private acting classes or?
No, I was in another improv group at the time.
Oh, okay.
So
what was their name?
Seven Course Theater.
Okay.
We did corporate improv.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Why did I? Was I in. I was probably in Athens.
Yeah, you were in Athens. Yeah, so this is my senior year of college.
Gotcha.
And
corporate improv.
Yeah, you'd go. So, I mean, you know, we did gigs at comedy
at,
shops.
At like IBM?
Oh. No, we did comedy shops as well. But, you know, they made their money like.
Oh, interesting.
You know, you're.
So you bring in someone to like entertain the staff or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. Here's a function. And tonight, you know, before the speaker comes on, we got improv. Give me a non-geographic location.
Right.
Great.
Right.
You know, so.
That's funny.
It was funny. And one of the best gigs I had with this group is that. Tell me to stop if I need to.
No.
But they they were hired by this big paper company to send the paper company would send all their management to these resorts for a week to learn how to yeah. hire better employees.
That's very Dunder Mifflin.
Yeah. And we were – these actors, it was like five of us would fly there and we had these fake backgrounds, these fake
right.
resumes, fake everything.
Oh, interesting.
And we would apply for these jobs. And uh-huh. they thought we were real people. They didn't know we were actors.
Huh.
And so you're sitting in a room – interviewing hour after hour for 5 hours with these people, and you're just lying to their face.
Yeah.
You know, and –
And that was a paid gig?
Yeah. It was like $350 for like the whole flight and travel. And, you know, you got to eat uh-huh. for 3 days.
And so you were just like a plant basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Huh.
But they – you know, but these are like eager managers. So they'd be like, hey, you know, you'd be outside like having coffee and they'd be like,
right.
hey, you know, yesterday you talked about living in Cincinnati. I'm from Cincinnati. Tell me about your favorite restaurant.
You're like, oh,
ooh.
Shit.
Yeah.
Like, I really like Outback Steaks.
I remember my friend coming out and he goes, I just told them I worked at a restaurant called Hot Buns. What the hell's Hot Buns?
Yeah, so then you go on to found the Whole World
yeah.
Theater,
right.
which was in Atlanta at the time, like a really big deal, I feel like.
It was fun. I mean, we were, you know, it was a dozen actor kids. We had no money. We just did it all ourselves.
Yeah.
We built the theater.
So cool.
We, you know, we ended up debating whether we wanted to move to LA to change our careers there
right.
or stay here. And I was working at a production company at the time. And
mm-hmm.
so I did some research and we bought all the cameras and we filmed our own TV pilot here. And we sold the show.
I remember that.
To
Castle Rock, right?
Well, first to Turner South.
Okay. Oh, that's right.
We did like 8 episodes for Turner South, and mm-hmm. then we sold the show to Castle Rock.
Right.
And then together we pitched Fox and created a pilot for Fox.
Right.
And that was around 2000. And then, you know, the pilot went nowhere. It was
right.
just like they spent like $700,000 on an improv show.
Yeah.
You know, which just sucked. And
such a different time for TV, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And it was nothing like what we started, you know. It was nothing – the pilot was nothing like the dirty, hardcore, just like crazy, funny, raw comedy that we were doing at the time.
Right.
And there's some amazing talent that – I mean, you know, these people who were actors with us at the time are, you know – Sarah Baker's gotten huge.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like all of you have gone on to do great things. Sarah Baker, for the listeners, she was in The Candidate and played Zach Galifianakis's wife in that movie, the Will Ferrell movie. But she made a lot of waves when she guested on Louie in that one episode.
Yeah, The Fat Girl Sings.
Yeah, man. She was so good in that. And Sarah's just – I mean, everyone was so talented, and I feel like everyone's gone on to do stuff. Lance has written for TV, and, like, Michael Snow did stuff for a while, right?
Yeah, I think so. He was doing stuff. Phil, like, you know, people are editors. Everybody seems to be either
– found their place.
Yeah. Anna, Lauren. I mean, they've all they're all doing really well in entertainment.
Yeah.
And I shuffled over to, you know, I remember when Lance left the theater, he's like, I'll give you 4 hours and I'll teach you how to edit. And I was like, okay, because I was like producing and he was editing. So he talked me, you know, in about 4 hours, taught me how to edit. And so that launched the next part of my career, going from actor to editor.
You did that for a while, huh?
Yeah. And I still will edit, you know, I mean.
It's because it's the most fun part of the process.
Well, you definitely have the most control over the story and the timing. And it's phenomenal what you can do in an edit room and what – you know, sometimes people just give you footage and just say, make this cool.
You still got your chops?
I don't know. I can sit in a room and tell you what, you know, how to, like, the timing here is off. And, you know,
I can sit in a room and tell you what sucks.
I try not to do that. but there are some really, you know, pretty fantastic editors that I work with, and you just go, oh, crap, I don't know all these things that you're doing now.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah, because it's like, I'm sure every 6 months there's new. Yeah. Plugins and information and tricks and stuff like that.
Right. And then, you know, I remember just being an editor and having some of my clients go, oh, I wish you would just direct this for us because you know, I was like, okay, I'll learn how to I'll direct it. You know, I know how to act. I know how to edit.
Yeah,
what's
that's
next?
Two huge advantages, I think, to be a director. And, of course, they're all stripes of great directors. But I think being a former actor or a current actor who directs is – I don't know, man. That's a really, like, nice thing to have in your hip pocket.
It's interesting because there are behind-the-scenes photos or videos and things like that of me, and you see me playing all the parts. Like, my face is contorting and my body's contorting, and I just play all the parts while I'm watching the monitor.
Oh, really?
And when the acting doesn't match up with what I'm doing, I realize either I'm wrong or they're wrong.
Oh,
and so
that's
when that's when I realized, like, okay, the timing on that beat wasn't right.
Right.
Because this is how I felt it the whole time.
Uh-huh.
So let's talk this through. And then I can give them notes of, like, you know, rather than, like, turn your face to the left and then say it, I'm just like, you know that feeling when your shoulder hurts and you have to get it out? You know, that's what I want right here. And it really hopefully helps the actors still give their performance, not my performance.
Right.
Except in the commercial world.
Yeah.
Where I do most of my work, where I'm just like, I literally need you to lean a millimeter to the left and wink that left eye.
Right,
ready,
right.
Go. I don't care. Like,
I'm sure that can get a little tedious with just – because you have to – you know, if you're listening and you never worked on, like, TV commercials and stuff, it's a – you have to walk a line as a director because you were hired to satisfy the client. And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
Like, you get to have your fun and sometimes you can sell them on your ideas and stuff, but sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
And you just got to suck it up and do it.
You
know?
And I mean, you know, you try to allow time for what you want in the schedule. So that, all right, we're going to get your thing. Give me 10 minutes to do my way.
To do the better way.
Yeah. And you often say, didn't you come up with this? Didn't I hear you say this like when we were having coffee that day? Well, let's just do it either way.
They probably always go, I totally did.
Yeah, I think so. Do you think it's funny? I still work in advertising. So
I know. I was about to say, we probably shouldn't. Yeah. They're all great.
They are. No, I mean, and right now my career went 20 years of freelance editing, directing, and everything. And now I'm full-time at an ad agency.
Just for like, 4 years now?
Yeah, I did 2 years at one agency, and now it's been a year and a half at another. And I'm running a department of a production company.
And yeah.
It's just like having my own production company, except we're salaried and we've got steady work.
Right.
And, you know,
that's kind of
amazing
nice.
People. Yeah. Yeah. And you get to take more risks and you get to spend the time that you want on a project
yeah.
instead of like, well, shit, I've only got one day allocated for this.
Right.
That's all I can do. So,
well, let's talk about good intentions because if the listener saw when. Very sadly, when Luke Perry died, I put up a post on the Movie Crushers page or the Movie Crush page about like the night that we all spent. You were the third – well, not the third part. Like you were the first part. You're the reason it happened. But that weird night we had hanging out on 90210 day.
Insane.
And he was just the nicest, best guy. And then when he passed away, everyone got all these stories. And I was glad that it was like validated that that he was this guy. So
yeah.
tell the story about Good Intentions, like how that movie came about.
So in 2005, I directed a short film, a 48-hour film festival.
Oh, right. That's right.
And I won the Atlanta portion of it, and then uh-huh. we went on to win the entire international festival.
Right. Which one was that?
It's called Moved.
Right.
Yeah. So and the producers that we partnered with on that, they had this script in development called mm-hmm. Good Intentions. So it was like, well, you did a good job with that. You know, do you want to come? Let's shoot it. We're going to shoot a trailer mm-hmm. for this. And I swear to God, we spent $100,000 shooting a trailer
really?
Back then. This is, you know, 06.
Yeah.
So it was all on film.
Mm-hmm.
We had local actors doing all the parts. And then the trailer we used to raise money for the rest of the movie.
Right.
You know, I'd actually wanted Harry Connick Jr. to play the role.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, he's neither Southern nor any of those things, but I just thought
he's Southern,
so much,
right?
Well, I guess he's in Louisiana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a certain kind of Southern, though.
Yeah. The producers were able to connect with Luke Perry. I think Harry wasn't available, and he had the same agent as Luke. So,
because you could afford like one name actor pretty much, right? I mean, well, that's not true because you had John Grice.
Yeah, Leanne Rimes.
Yeah, that's right. They all worked pretty cheap,
yeah.
though. They had to have.
Yeah. And John Grice was like my win, like him and Jimmy Simpson. Like, you know.
Oh, Jimmy Simpson. That's right.
Yeah.
Like, boy,
those
he's
two
great.
People. I mean, he is really funny.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like the stuff that he's been doing lately is all drama.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember I had this movie in development and I called him up. I was like, hey, you know, Jimmy, you know, I want you to come play this movie. I'm going to offer you the part. And he's like, and his response is like, oh, you need to talk to my manager. I'm like,
oh, man.
But I didn't realize like he actually had a career path in mind.
Yeah.
Not just like bouncing around from project to project.
But it's that thing where you're like, oh, I'm not even going to like make you audition. Like
yeah.
you got the part.
Yeah.
And he's like, Yeah, I've had that stuff happen.
Yeah, I don't shine shoes no more. You know, get your fucking shine
yeah,
box.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And you actually, I mean, we've always looked out for each other, and you you got me to do some rewrites on the script before I mean, I had never done anything. Remember that?
Yeah.
I did some rewrites, and I rewrote a couple of scenes that, like, it was the first time I'd ever had like actors say words that I wrote.
I forgot about
that.
That
was filmed. One of them was a Jimmy scene.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That was really cool.
That's
so,
cool. Well, you had written
years later.
You had written Sweet Sweet Spirit, which mm-hmm. I was such a fan of.
Yeah.
And still, you know, still am. I think. I mean, is that going to happen?
Oh,
we make that
no.
movie. It would work great. I want to do it like all African American cast.
That'd be good
that way. Yeah.
That's a good twist on that.
Yeah.
So I got to write some stuff, and then for those of you who listened to the Tony Shalhoub episode, Jim was the conduit there too because you met Tony years ago on the movie that Brooke directed, right?
Tony directed.
Oh, Tony directed.
Yeah, Brooke.
Made up?
Yeah, made up. Brooke and her sister Lynn wrote the movie.
Okay, that's right.
So good story. Me and Lance and our friend Kaylin had just driven across country
mm-hmm.
and we were going to stay at Tony's house. Like I'd befriended Tony years before
mm-hmm.
and we were going to stay in his guest house for a few days. And he's like, you know, my wife wants me to direct this movie and I don't want to invest in it. I don't want to put my money in. I'm like, okay, I got an idea. So I call up my friend, this guy, Bob,
who's uh-huh.
had, like tons of money. He invested in a bunch of other stuff. I'm like, hey, Bob, it's Jim. I'm at Tony Shalhoub's house. Listen, if we play our cards right, I might be able to get you to invest to executive produce his next movie. I gotta go. Bye. And he's like, what was that? I was like, don't worry about it. We're gonna work this out.
Uh-huh.
And literally, call back 10 minutes later. I'm like, listen, Bob, when are you gonna be in LA? Because Tony's going to make a movie, and I want you to produce it. Uh-huh. And he's like, I'll be there next week. I'm like, get us a table at Spago, stat, in Spago in the 90s, you know.
Right.
It's like, it's Saturday night at 8 o'clock. Make it happen, Bob. And sure enough, there's like 10 of us. You know, it's like Tony and Brooke and Bob, all the grown-ups, uh-huh. and then me and like 7 of our idiot friends right. all sitting around this table in the middle of Spago, food fights and like being silly. And I remember all these like celebrities nearby.
Yeah.
And Tony and Brooke are talking to Bob about like, you know, well, the investment and returns and blah, blah, blah. Right. You know, and Bob's like, you know, he's a carpet millionaire. Right. He doesn't care. And I'm like, wait, don't you guys have extra Academy Award tickets? You should take Bob. Let's all go to the Oscars.
Oh, my God.
And Bob's like, wait, you can do that? And we're like, yeah, yeah, let's all go to the Oscars. And the next day, he's like, I'm committed. We're funding this movie. And he funded the movie. Like,
wow.
You know, when you get to a point and you're in your 70s and you've got a shit ton of money,
yeah.
like, you want to go to the Oscars. You don't, you know, making $50,000 back on your 100. You know, he doesn't care about that
yeah.
stuff. So. So that's how that movie
came
together.
Did he go to
together.
The Oscars?
Yeah, he went.
Okay.
Yeah, he went, they took him for like 2 years. He called the next year. He's like, you still got Oscars tickets? They're like, yeah. So then after that, they just started giving him the tickets. He went like 5 years in a row to
yeah.
the Oscars.
Wow.
And he'd take his friends, you know, his
that's
other
awesome.
People. Yeah.
But I mean, talking to Tony was just like, he was at your wedding, so I met him there.
Yeah.
But sitting down with him in New York for the Butch Cassidy episode was – you know how, like, we both just have so much respect for him, and it was just slightly surreal to, like, finally be in a room and, like, talking one-on-one with him with that voice of his. And
yeah.
He's just, I don't know.
He's nice
great.
As can be.
Yeah, just.
First time I met him, so I met his sister, and we don't have to talk too much about this, but I met his sister, and she's like, oh, you have to meet my brother. You remind me so much of him.
Uh-huh.
She had come to, like, some acting things, some whole world performances. So I flew to L.A. to meet him,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sitting in a, you know, talking to him, nervous, sweating, just sweat. And I start quoting movies that he had done.
Barton Fink.
Yeah, Barton Fink, you know, Lou, how's Lipnick's ass smell this morning? What?
So
shit, no. You know, and then I started quoting the soup Nazi to him.
Oh, no.
He was not the soup Nazi.
He looks a lot like him, though.
Yeah, so he was kind. I didn't realize until weeks later that it wasn't
Hey,
him.
Tony, no soup for you. Did he even know what you were talking about? Or
yeah,
was he just like, why
just
is
nice.
He saying I can't have
he
soup?
He was nice. He just didn't make me feel stupid.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's the guy he is. So,
oh, man.
Yeah. And we, you know, we went and saw him at in the band's visit last year. And
oh, that's
fantastic.
Right. Yeah, you went to New York and saw him on Broadway.
And, you know, we went and he introduced my daughter to the cast and took her backstage
so cool.
and she got to hang out. I'm like, honey, this is not how you don't normally get to hang out in the star's dressing room after the show. So.
Yeah, you have to do that with kids when they get to do special things like that because kids are just like, oh, yeah, sure. Like my dad knows the lead actor. He's like, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
You should appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. He's a good guy. I appreciate that hookup. Mm-hmm. Brooke was very sweet as well.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. Should we talk about Rushmore?
Sure, yeah.
So you went back and forth a little bit and sent sort of a list over like some people do. Almost Famous was it for a while. We almost talked about that, which would have been great because I love that movie.
I do too. And because we play in a rock and roll band together, I thought we could.
Oh, that's right. I should – Jim is the drummer, everyone, for El Cheapo.
El Cheapo, yeah. So I thought, you know, that would be a good angle for us because we could talk music all day. But the Rushmore soundtrack is
– yeah.
One of the greatest soundtracks of all time,
for sure.
At least for my generation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I, to this day, still edit, and we use that, the hardest geometry problem for like half the pitch videos that we'll do.
Yeah.
It'll start off.
It's pretty great. Well, I watched this last night for the gazillionth time, and as soon as that music starts and I think it's Touchstone logo comes up,
yeah.
It just like, I got a little chill right now even. It's just so evocative because this movie was – like I had – Bottle Rocket is one of three movies that stand out to me that my brother called me up and said, go see. In high school, he told me to go see Blue Velvet. Mm. Early college, he told me to go see Shallow Grave.
Oh.
And then Bottle Rocket. He was like, you got to go see Bottle Rocket. Just find it. Trust me. Go see it.
Yeah.
And so I had seen Bottle Rocket in the theater, which not a ton of people – can claim to have done mm-hmm. because, you know, Wes Anderson before he was Wes Anderson. But this kind of was too. Like he got a little bit of currency with Bottle Rocket, but not really. Like this movie was still done on the cheap and was still a proving ground for him.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I read that he traveled around with a bus and two big screen TVs, like doing like
–
with Swordsman. Screenings,
yeah,
of it. And Bottle Rocket was, I think I don't know if it was more Wes Anderson than this. Like it was sort of defined, I think, how he would shoot this movie.
Yeah.
I had to think that he at least had all these ideas in his head and maybe wasn't sure that they were going to work on camera. And then, you know, tested them out on Bottle Rocket.
Yeah,
and
like
sure enough,
the DNA of Wes Anderson is all in Bottle Rocket. I had already did that one with Dave Willis. But Rushmore was, I think, more true to what his ultimate vision would be, which is required a little bit more money. Even though this was still low budget compared to what he would go on to like, you know, budgets he would get later in his career. Mm-hmm. But Rushmore is still pretty much on the cheap. Like I read Bill Murray, he wanted to do it for free.
Yeah.
But he worked for scale and I think he made $9,000 on it.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
and he even – there was a helicopter scene that was supposed to be in it and Disney wouldn't pay for it.
Yeah.
But he offered to pay for the scene.
Yeah. Just said he gave him a blank check and was like, do what you need to do. Yeah. But they didn't do it.
I want to know where this helicopter scene – it was supposed to be him and Blum and Schwartzman. Like
yeah.
That.
You know, it was – I mean, knowing Wes Anderson, it was probably just him like taking an aerial tour of the aquarium site or something. Because
yeah.
That scene is so – I mean, we're going to jump around, but that scene is so great when he asks, you know, about spending money on the – when he first goes to see him. And he's like, I think $100,000 for the initial plans. And Bill Murray has that great take where he just – and he gets out that big checkbook. I'll give you $2,500.
I think it's – yeah. And just the opening shot of the movie is a portrait of, of the family, you know. And you just establish like
– oh, yeah.
His attitude.
He just looks unhappy.
Ronnie and Donnie.
Oh, man, those guys.
I mean, just a fantastic – like, you know, you want your opening shot. You think about that opening shot.
Oh, yeah.
All like, how do I open this
movie? Your first
movie?
And your last shots are just so important.
Yeah, and it's a portrait of the Blum family.
So that music's going on. You see that portrait. And then I always talk on the show a lot about the efficiencies of character setup and, like, when a director can just nail a character in, like, the opening sequence – especially with few words, it's just like masterful to me. And this, that dream sequence of the hardest geometry problem that says everything you need to know about Max Fisher.
Yeah.
That's his – it would have been cool anyway, but that's what he's daydreaming about. Or I guess he's fully asleep, but he's daydreaming about being the hero for solving a math problem.
Yeah, and he's got his tea in his hand. Uh-huh. You know, he just – the professor chucks him that chalk, you know, and just gets right into it, you know.
And just set the tone so, like, perfectly.
He's the hero. He saved the day
of
that class ever having to do homework again.
Well, and it's funny because that, you know, I've seen all these movies usually a bunch of times. But when you really look at it through this critical eye, you notice so much more. But all throughout the movie, that's all he's doing is trying to impress people. Like, he saved Latin. And the geometry thing was a dream, but he saved them from that. Yeah. He builds the aquarium for her. Like, most of it's for Miss Cross, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But all he's doing is trying to, like, impress people with his actions because I think he knows that he's – I mean, we think he has a great personality. But in true to life, Max Fisher is, like, probably not fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and honestly, I was trying to think – I was like, am I – was I like Max Fisher in high school? Like I talked my way into a lot of – like I was not that great of a student, but I was in all these electives.
That's
I was
a little
like,
Max Fisher in both of us, I think.
I think so, yeah. And I think that's maybe why we relate to the character in the movie and we like him. And,
yeah.
You know, I think
– and you were sort of playing adult a little bit too.
Yeah.
At a younger age.
I definitely was.
Like
I,
you were a 16-year-old working in a suit shop in the mall – with like – you were the youngest guy there by 20 years probably.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, we can talk about that place. But, you know, like I see also in my daughter a lot of the Max Fisher. Like,
really?
She's – you know, she goes to a kind of an elite private school.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and she –
that's the Rushmore of Atlanta probably.
Yeah, and she wants everything to be in a specific way.
Uh-huh.
And she's the team leader for – you know, in her class.
Yeah.
And she's always making sure things are happening.
But,
luckily
Maxine Fisher.
Yeah.
So it cuts right from there to – well, first of all, the premise of the movie basically – and you know this when you watch it and you're a fan of Rushmore. Like, yeah, he acts so adult. But the whole kind of premise of the movie is what if there was a kid who – behaved completely like an adult, and everyone else around him treated him like an adult. And I looked it up, and sure enough, Wes Anderson's direct quote, you know, he wrote this with Owen Wilson, of course. And I miss those Owen Wilson co-written scripts. I think those are the best ones, those first three. But he said, one of the most appealing things to us was the initial idea of a 15-year-old kid and a 50-year-old man becoming friends and equals. And that's really – that's the DNA of the whole movie.
Yeah.
From him offering to pay for, like, the concession stand treats. Like, no, I got
this.
At
the wrestling match.
Yeah. I mean, it's all – and him having, like, a scotch at dinner.
Yeah.
It's all, like – they all treat him like an adult, which is just the best, like, running gag in the whole movie.
I kind of thought – I wondered if – is Max, like, a young Dignan? Is, you know, is
– oh,
like,
interesting.
With all that planning everything out and having – you know, here's a 5-year plan and here's a 10-year plan. Here's our 50-year plan.
I think so, and I think they're all a little Wes Anderson.
Or Owen Wilson.
Well, a little bit of both. Apparently, Wes Anderson – Owen Wilson was the side of Max that got kicked out of private school.
Yeah.
He got kicked out and went to the public school. And the Wes Anderson side was he had a real crush on an older woman and I think was tried to endear himself through, like, you know, solving issues and, you know, saving Latin and stuff like that.
Yeah. I wonder if he succeeded.
He auditioned like 1,800 kids and then someone introduced him to Schwartzman, who now it's like, you know, it's Jason Schwartzman. But back then he was no one.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a Coppola, so
right.
He had to lug up, obviously.
And he showed up at the audition with a blazer and he made a little Rushmore patch stitched onto it. And now his mom was is Coppola's sister.
I think so, right?
And she was in Rocky. Right? Wasn't she?
Oh, is his mom Talia Shire?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Francis Ford Coppola's sister.
Right.
So he's cousins of Sophia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she introduced him to Wes Anderson. She's
right.
The one who got him the audition.
I think so. Yeah. Amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. I know that they, he wanted to cast Noah Taylor, who you would, he was actually in Almost Famous. He played the shitty manager. He's the English guy.
Oh.
He's been at a gazillion
things. Oh, yeah.
But I looked at him and I was – because they wanted him to be sort of a skinny – first of all, it was going to be set in London. And then when he got expelled, he was going to go to Detroit because he wanted the two most polar opposite experiences.
Yeah.
But then they just set it all in Houston. But Noah Taylor is 11 years older. He's my age. He's our age. And I was like, that doesn't work at all. He's 11 years older than Jason Schwartzman even.
That's weird.
So he would have been – and is like mid to late 20s playing a 15-year-old, which, I mean, he as a scrawny guy, he may have gotten away with it. But I just think that Jason Schwartzman, like they said he reminded him of like a Dustin Hoffman, which I think you get a lot of that graduate homage all through the movie.
For sure. God, there was a couple other references to The Graduate.
The pool scene is for sure.
Yeah.
Like when Benjamin in The Graduate, when he is in the scuba suit and just sort of stays underwater for a while, Bill Murray sort of does that after his cannonball.
Just throw chucking. And the little kid, I think I remember listening to the director's commentary 20 years ago or something.
Uh-huh.
And the little kid who's swimming in the pool.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not Dirk. It's like this other kid.
Yeah.
He was like an extra that they saw on day one. And then I think Wes Anderson just started putting him like in all these
scenes.
He's
in a bunch of scenes.
Yeah, and it's hilarious. And I remember telling my wife when we were watching the other day, I was like, oh, there's the kid, the blah, blah, blah. She's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, he's in all the scenes. You'll see.
Is this a guy's movie? Because I've heard that accusation before. Emily loves it. But like, you know, Stacey, Stacey Horn, she was like, that's a total guy's movie. Like, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
I was like, well, maybe it is.
Maybe. I mean, I think we all had that, like we always wanted to have this plan and put it together and everything was an adventure. It's like, what's the baseball movie with the kids? The Sandlot.
Sandlot,
you know, where everything was just like, all right, we got to do this plan. Let's go do it.
Right.
You know, and I know that me and my friends all like
or Stand By Me.
Yeah, everything was like this adventure, and you had to like
for sure
make it happen.
Yeah,
and it was like life or death. So, I kind of see that from a guy in the 80s relating to it.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's still
I think it
kinda
appealed to a certain guy at a certain age for sure, which is to say us. But I think I'm curious to hear some feedback from the ladies to see what they think about this movie. But you've got that great speech of Bill Murray about Rushmore and taking out the rich. And that's where that seed is planted. And yeah. Afterward, Bill Murray's talking about what a sharp guy. And Brian Cox with the line, he's one of the worst students we've got. And then it goes into that, you know, one of the, I think, three or four montages. And they didn't want the studio was, I think, gave him a hard time about the school activity montage, which is so fucking great.
Yeah.
Because you know how, as a director, like, it's a 3-second shot to set everything up for just, like, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. But Wes Anderson apparently was adamant. So as a director, what do? You just knock them out when you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can relate with, although I did not succeed as Wes Anderson did, when we did Good Intentions, the movie starts, the way the movie starts now, it's actually page 11. So there was 10 pages of opening scene that set everything up, like from the, you know, from the late 70s, early 80s. It's like this flash, this like opening scene from, you know, when Etta, the main character, was a child.
Uh-huh.
So.
Oh, that's right. That wasn't, like, that didn't make the final
no,
cut?
No, it not only did not make the final cut, it never got shot. Oh. You know, about 7 days into shooting, we realized some.
Like, what do you got to lose?
Yeah, what do you got to cut?
Yeah.
And that was, you know, but Wes Anderson's like, screw it, we're going to do this. And they just did these pickup shots, like,
yep,
whenever they could.
That's
they
how you do
made
it.
Them happen.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff you've been on set where you're like, all right, let's do like a half lunch. Like, is that okay with you guys?
Yeah.
And, you know, the actors are always game for stuff like that.
Yeah. And now, as you know, I mean, I do that stuff all the time. And you ask my producers, they hate me because I'm
sure.
You know, I'm
you're
like
stealing people and cameramen and like, come on, let's go.
Oh, yeah. And they're like, hey, Jim, you know, we can't do 27 shots in one day. I'm like, yeah, we can.
Yeah.
I got it all figured out. Come on, guys, let's do this. Who's with me? You know, and every shoot, it's just becoming more and more ridiculous of like,
yeah.
But, you know, you find a way because there's no way, like, which of my babies am I going
right.
to lose? I'm not losing any. So. And that's fantastic. And as a filmmaker and a commercial director in the early 2000s, you know, you basically every pitch you went into seemed that was a comedy. They're like, you know, like Wes Anderson.
Right.
And I swear to God, and I still say this, like I would go into a meeting and I would kind of listen to what the creative directors would say.
Right.
And I would say that, and I was like, yeah, you know, I want to do that, but with a little more Wes Anderson to it. And they'd be like, oh, you're brilliant.
Right.
You're so right. I'm like, right? You know, a little center cut, punch. And
yeah,
then cut.
Yeah.
I did not think of that.
Yeah.
Like, oh. So
let's do these real symmetrical frames.
Yeah.
Widescreen.
And then there was a time in, like, during the recession when I literally was put up for a spot. And I'm like, who else is up for this? And like, oh, Wes Anderson. I'm like, well,
really?
Yeah. I
wow.
mean, everybody at that point was like all of a sudden we're doing the
yeah.
the lower tier jobs.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, so I'm seriously not even a consideration now.
Get someone to give you that Botenfink feeling.
Yeah. Oh, that Botenfink feeling. And since you're Botenfink, you got it in spades. Seriously, Boten.
So what's your favorite of his activities? Because they just bombard you and they're all so funny. I think I wrote down a bunch, but my favorite I think ended up being the Bombardment Society with the dodgeball.
Yeah.
Well, just so silly and fun.
I love that he brought fencing to the
Grover Cleveland.
Yeah. But it wasn't, you know, he's just going to practice, you know,
yeah.
in the middle of the basketball practice.
Right.
So.
Well, but he said in his little speech, he's like, I noticed you guys know the fencing club. I really want to try to get one started for you guys.
Yeah.
Almost as if, like, I know I'm going to be gone, but I'm going to leave something behind for you. And that is the fencing club.
Yeah. The Max Fisher Fencing Society.
Oh, man. It's so good. And of course I have just a ton of lines in here that I'll randomly read as we go. I'm sure you have the same, but when he's, he and Brian Cox have that great scene when he's trying to negotiate his stay, even though he's like failing everything.
Yeah.
He goes, he has two lines that killed me. And that is one is, can I see some documentation on that, please? And then he goes at the very end of that scene, he goes, can we just let me float by for old time's sake?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Brian Cox so good in that of just like
– yeah, he's awesome.
You know, and you think about him now and you're just like, oh my gosh. Like he has just – I mean he's had that presence on camera forever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and just the way he just looks at Max and talks to Max. I'm just like, no, we're not doing this again.
Yeah.
We've been here. We've had this conversation 6,000 times. You
yeah.
know?
It's a case – and I think we've all – I mean you and I – had a little Max in us for sure because I remember teachers that – it's sort of like Brian Cox that they're exasperated.
Yeah.
But they also know that we're like – they didn't dislike us. We weren't bad kids.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of like parent-teacher conferences where my mom would go in and be like, oh, Chuck's mom. Like, you know, a little disruptive maybe.
Yeah.
Was the worst thing you could say about us?
Well, we, you know, we didn't necessarily just want to do the book report the way the teacher wants the whole class to do the book report. It's like instead of – wait, this was
– Look at us now.
Yeah. There was it was in college – I had to do in Spanish class. It's like, you know, you have to give a speech in Spanish.
Right.
So instead of doing that, I sang I'm Too Sexy in Spanish for the class. So I had the music. I had a bald head. You know, it's like, I don't want to do a speech. Can I just sing I'm Too Sexy?
Well, and then, you know, you're one of those kids that was probably like, well, technically it is a speech just because it's got a tune to it.
Right.
Teachers love that stuff.
I loved Kumar, you know, Kumar, Mr. Little Jeans, you know.
He and his son were both in this.
Yeah.
Because his son was, in real life, was the math teacher who was the bookstore guy in Bottle Rocket.
Yeah.
And sadly, he's Mr. Little Jeans passed away, you know, a few years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's not around.
Best play ever. So his line is, best play ever. My favorite is in Bottle Rocket, Kumar is like, Kumar. You know, he's like, what happened, man? Oh, I fucked up, man.
I fucked up, man. Well, and he's at the end of the Max Fisher play of Heaven and Hell. He's just dying laughing, and they get that one like super close up shot of him just like laughing his ass off with the safety glasses on.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's so great.
Best play ever.
So we are introduced then to the Max Fisher, the idea of Max Fisher Productions, which is a through line through the movie of I thought, was he doing Serpico?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was early. He did Serpico at Rushmore.
No, what was the one he did at Grover Cleveland where they were like gangsters? Remember they had the scene where he's like the gangster in the car?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what that was. I think that was just a made up. I think that was something he wrote.
Fisher original.
Yeah, I think so.
And then the end was Heaven and Hell. Was that supposed to be Oliver Stone's?
Yeah, it was like an Apocalypse Now thing.
Because I think didn't Oliver Stone have a movie called Heaven and Hell?
Oh, I don't know.
I think so. About a soldier who Tommy Lee Jones. Maybe it wasn't called Heaven and Hell. My Lee.
Yeah, interesting.
But we get introduced to the Max Fisher Productions part, and again, he sends a kid out for root beer, just a very adult thing to do.
Get everybody root beer. I don't have all –
Yeah, I don't want any.
I don't want any, yeah.
But that's like the first 10 minutes of the movie is so chock full of character. It's just all character, character, character. You know, for everyone, you're like the level – the table is set basically at that point.
Do you think as a – I mean, as a writer, can you – do you feel like you're bombarding people with – I mean – you know, you try to introduce people in their environment slowly throughout scripts now. You know, I think we think of like TV pilots, TV shows, often the pilot is like that. You're bombarding all the characters.
Pilots are so tough.
Getting everything in there so you've got an understanding. But in a movie, I mean, how often is that done where you kind of establish everybody from the beginning? Like, da-da, these are the players, and now let's go down our paths with each of them.
I don't know. I mean, this definitely had a stage play feel at times. And, you know, he used the motif of the curtains opening and closing.
Which they shot practically, right?
Really?
Yeah, those were in the – they were, you know, a couple
right in front of the camera?
Yeah, right in front of the camera.
Little miniatures?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
Love filmmaking tricks.
Yeah.
But then we finally, we meet Ronnie and Donnie, which is great. When get your head out of your ass. There's going to be girls there.
So my sister-in-law and her husband live on Johns Island, South Carolina, like this big, you know, giant, beautiful acreage. And they had these two stray orange cats that kept coming around the house and they couldn't name them. And I was like, it's Ronnie and Donnie. And they named them Ronnie and Donnie. They look and act just like them. They come out and they fight each other and then they leave, you know. So.
And then we meet Max's dad, another guy who's left us, Seymour Cassell, recently. Yeah. And this character and their relationship I thought was so interesting to really study last night because it never feels father and son.
Right.
It almost feels like Max lives alone and this is his nice neighbor.
I couldn't quite understand. Is he trying to ground Max? Like, are we trying to get like, you know, this is Max's grounding. He's a human and there's interaction with Like, how does he interact with his dad? Is that what he's supposed to be like at home when he's not trying to put on a performance?
Like, that's
but he's
sort
still
of the
very
real,
distant.
Yeah, it is weird. Like, they don't feel like they're close. And the character is such a sweet guy, you know, when he tries to change his grade. And
yeah, it's almost an A.
Yeah, but there's so many, like, Max is so dismissive of him constantly, including in that really sad scene at the end where he goes, you know, face it, I'm a barber's son. And he looks wounded finally, like he finally got to him.
Yeah.
And he kind of wrecks all the relationships throughout the movie. And then the last 20 minutes is him repairing all those.
Yeah. It is particularly sad in that, you know, that you expect to see him acting differently around the guy who sacrificed everything.
Yeah.
You know, to take care of him. Or, you know, I mean, you don't get a sense that the dad was selfish and he's become a barber because that's what he wants to do.
No,
you know,
like his mom died when he was 7.
Yeah.
He's 15, so he's been raising the son for 8 years by himself.
Yeah.
And Max, I mean, Max isn't an asshole, but he's, you know, he lies about who he is. He's ashamed of who he is.
Yeah. And his dad wants to come to dinner after the show and he's like, cast only, dad.
Yeah.
Cast and crew only. It's like, oh.
And he asks if he needs money. He's like, no, dad.
Yeah. Just real condescending.
I know. I felt bad for him through most of the movie. But everyone does, you know, of course, because it's Owen Wilson and Wes Anderson, everyone gets their, comes full circle. And at the end of the film, he gets asked to dance by that lady, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was good. So Max finally meets Cross and the first act that he performs with her is lighting her cigarette with his Zippo on the bleachers. And that scene is so good.
It is. And, you know, and he like enters the frame and then leaves the frame.
Yeah.
And then he enters the frame again and then he comes down.
Yeah.
And there's a couple scenes like that. There's a scene where
I know what you're about to say.
Where Bill Murray's at the front porch, right?
Yeah.
Same situation.
With the steps.
Yeah. And then when they cut back to the wide shot, you see that space was really big.
Yeah, yeah.
So the actor actually had to make this big attempt to make those movements. And it's difficult as an actor to take those steps and go so far and to communicate with somebody. So there's a separation that Wes Anderson was doing to the actors in the scene that forces you to have to try a little bit harder to connect. You know, it's easy to connect. You and I were sitting across from each other.
Right.
You can't help it.
Right.
You know, but when you put Max behind her and to the left, you know, he has to really reach to connect with her.
Yeah.
And she's got, you know, she's reading, I wrote it down, but, you know, he's trying to find any excuse to come over.
Right.
And then to light that cigarette and, you know, as a filmmaker, you're
like. Yeah. The geography of a scene and the blocking is so important. And I think that's like the layman doesn't know about this stuff and how important that is.
Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, you want one character facing one way and one another. And in the reality of things, those two areas are not next to each other. So, you have to fake it. But also you don't want this to be so different emotionally and texturally to the actor, to where their eyes look different, to where their, you know, the space affects you.
I mean,
you know, you really, as a director, you want to create an atmosphere, make sure the blocking works, invigorate your actors to have an emotional connection, and then let them play within the scene.
Right.
And if the texture of the room or the situation changes, it really makes completely different performances.
Yeah, because, I mean, to get a scene in the can, like, directing the actors is not the easiest part, but, like, it's got to work for camera. It's got to work for lighting.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, like, all these things have to work together, and then you have to get the fucking scene to work.
Right, yeah. And you know, and what's interesting is a lot of times what we'll do is, you know, you end one scene – and the next thing you do is you get your actors and your keys, you know, the cinematographer and the key gaffer and the grip. You know, you get us in the room and then we rehearse the scene, block it out. And that's when you're really, for the first time, like, shit, this location was great 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And now that the actors are here, you know,
it's
somebody
different.
Wants to do something. So you're really kind of refiguring it out.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, you've got 30 or 40 people standing around kind of watching this process happen, and you really just kind of want everybody to go away and let me just play with the actors. And sometimes we call for that.
Like,
you know, everybody, like, you know, this is just me and the keys or me and the talent, you know, and you have to, at that point, really figure out in my heart, in 3 weeks ago when I was here blocking this by myself and the DP, mm-hmm. it all made sense. And right. now the actor's trying something different and it's not working. Is it my instinct that's wrong mm-hmm. or is it their instinct that's wrong? And you know, and I remember one scene that I shot years ago, and I remember the director of photography talking me out of how I initially wanted to shoot it.
Really?
And I was like, well, he must be right. You know,
and he was wrong.
It didn't work the way it uh-huh. should have worked, you know? And from then on, and same with Good Intentions. I walked into a room and John Grice and Gary, they're super tall, two super tall dudes, like, hey, we want to talk to you about this scene.
Right.
You know, and they're trying to talk me out of it. And you as a director have to really figure out, like,
yeah, like
these are really smart people.
Yeah.
Is my instinct wrong or is their instinct wrong? And
I think that's part of the trick of being a director, though, a good one is like, you got to be nimble. Mm-hmm. You got to know when to stick to your guns and when to open yourself up to that collaboration. And when you do stick to your guns, to make it appear like you're still open and not, you know, you can't be like a dictator.
Yeah, but people certainly smell blood in the water. And it's,
right.
you know, once
show weakness.
show weakness or show like you don't understand
yeah,
what you're
yeah.
doing.
Like this guy doesn't know what he's doing. That's no
tough.
Good.
Right. You know, I mean, you want this chair or this chair? You know, that one.
Right.
I'm wholeheartedly committing to that red chair right now.
I saw a thing where Wes Anderson said on the first day of shooting, he whispered his direction to Bill Murray kind of quietly because he was afraid to get shot down in front of everyone.
Yeah.
And Bill Murray, of course, was Bill Murray. So that just wasn't the case.
It's petrifying.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I'm sure. Because he was still just so green, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, bottle rocket aside, like Bill Murray was a big – it was Bill Murray.
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, I hear stories of actors, you know, like commercial directors trying to give movie stars directions, you know, and the movie star just saying, screw you, this is what I do. You don't tell me what to do.
There's that famous clip of De Niro, right, where someone's trying to direct De Niro for like a PSA he was doing, and he was just kind of like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, Rosebud,
Orson
Welles.
Yeah.
Do you ever listen to that audio clip of?
Oh no!
Oh my gosh, it is the best berating of a radio ad you've ever heard. I mean,
I think I have heard that. Yeah.
He's trying to do like set. Oh my gosh, it's fantastic. I had
that
an experience
makes me so uncomfortable.
With John Grice when we were filming. So we're like day 20, 21, something of this like 30-day shoot.
Right.
And it was a scene I just didn't care about. I didn't know what to do in it. And I did that thing where, you know, he's like, tell me what to do and give him a couple notes. I'm like, you know, have fun with it. And I walk away.
Oh, boy.
And he's like, no, like in front of everybody.
Yeah.
You don't do that to me.
That's like a bullshit direction.
Yeah. You don't tell me to have fun with it. You don't know what you want. You figure out what you want me to figure it out here in front of everybody with the cameras rolling.
Oh, Jesus.
And it was just – and, you know, I mean, I was probably 30 years old, 28, 20, you know. And
That's tough.
Never said that since then, you know, because –
yeah.
Everybody says it. Like, you know, have fun with it. It's like,
right.
Fuck you. You don't know what you want.
Yeah, that is kind of bullshit.
And I literally just like, okay, do this.
Yeah.
And he did it. And, you know, but it is a task you're putting on somebody else to figure out. And it's just not fair. And, you know, and I think that Wes Anderson is very specific in exactly what he wants.
Yeah, for sure.
And he can get that across, but yet still let you be Bill Murray and let you still be Owen Wilson.
I think you feel a lot of Bill Murray's stuff in here. Like I've never read the script, but like I guarantee you in the script, it doesn't say after he goes and visits Mrs. Cross by himself for the first time and the little kid, that cute ass little kid is painting the painting.
Yeah.
That after they talk, you know, Herman Bloom turns and sprints away
off
the playground.
Yeah.
Like that, there's no way. That's like you could feel Bill Murray just making some weird choice.
Yeah.
And I laughed again last night and I was like, what is he doing? Why is he running like that? Or the, you know, when he stuffs the kid on the basketball court. Like there's so many playful Bill Murray moments that you can tell sort of came from him.
But there's something about that crush, you know, that Bill Murray's having that he probably hasn't had in 30 years, you know, so he is a kid again.
Well, he acts like when he leaves on their date at 2 a.m. when Max is sitting in the car, I never really notice it, but he runs down the sidewalk like a little kid after a first date. And it's just like fucking adorable. And he gets in the car and, you know, Max is sitting in the back seat like the Grim Reaper.
Oh, my gosh. And he just looks back.
Yeah.
You know, he looks at him like, I knew you were going to catch me one of these days.
So, all right. Now, Max is in love with Miss Cross. It's clear from the beginning. And they have that great, great bonding moment with the scene with the fish. And it's real easy. I made a note here. It's like really easy just to sort of laugh at Max Fisher and Jason Schwartzman. It's like he's so precocious and this and that. But he's doing some really great acting in this movie.
Yeah.
Especially in that scene. Like just blew me away how like he was able to connect with her and like –
where she's talking about how she was married
before.
Yeah,
and he's talking about how his mom died. Yeah, it's like it's such a good scene.
Yeah.
And she's very undersung in this movie.
Yeah.
Because you got this big personalities all around her and she's just like this solid central core.
And you know, you're able to appreciate them because of the work that she's doing.
Yeah.
To just be steady and – like she just delivers her lines so well that, that gives them room to be subtle and be real.
Yeah.
And then to be not obnoxious, but to be over the top and just, you know.
Because she couldn't be.
Yeah.
She had to be I mean, she's the only sort of realistic character in the movie.
Right.
In some ways.
Right.
And that's tough, I think, to like she doesn't get to go big or do anything kind of fun or crazy. Yeah. But she's really good. I think she's very undersung in this film.
And that's hard as an actor because everybody around you is getting the laughs and everybody around you is getting the, oh, great job.
Yeah.
That was so good. And, you know, you want to be a part of the gang.
Yeah,
you know?
To be impressive or whatever.
That's happened a lot where, you know, somebody, you know, an actor will do something that's hilarious, you know, that's just – and everybody on the crew is laughing and the producers are laughing and the financing people are laughing and you're like – but that's not what I want right there.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to fight it. And you know that when you get to the edit room, you're going to have to fight it. And you're just, you know, it's hard to stick to your guns as a filmmaker when you're controlling the exact tone. And when the actor needs that, like, appreciation.
Yeah,
or
they
something.
Need that little ego boost.
Yeah.
Actors have egos? So they do the first play. And then there's a few, like, Max is always the acting like an adult, but there are like a few really distinct times in the movie where he is a 15-year-old, and one of them is at the post-play dinner with Luke Wilson.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. I have a couple of lines in here. I like your nurse's uniform, guy.
Such a dick.
But he's such an asshole to him. But this is one of the scenes where he acts like a child because – after, you know, so I'm, you know, I wrote a hit play and directed it, so I'm not sweating it either.
Yeah.
Like he's putting on this front, but he finally acts like a child. And you even hear his voice go up and he goes, you hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
And like, he's like, it's a reminder, like he's fucking 15.
Yeah. And is he a spoiled brat who's just finally just like, I'm going to use my hurt my feelings card? Or is he really his feelings hurt?
I think he's a kid who's in love for the first time, doesn't know what to do with these feelings.
Yeah.
Like he thinks he has a legitimate shot with her.
Yeah.
Until it turns sexual in that later scene, which is just brutal.
Yeah. Well, and he's trying of that. And I wrote a hit play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really? I mean, you're really going to go up against this OR nurse, you know, this adult.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, that's when the reality comes crashing down on him. Like nothing. He writes the play, he saves Latin, he does all these things to impress her, and she is impressed, but like he can't have the one thing he wants, which is to be 30.
Yeah. Well, she says to him, like, well, that was never do you not find me attractive?
Or
she says, that doesn't, has that, nothing to do with it.
Doesn't come into it. And he's like, if you say so.
I mean, just those little subtle moments.
Yeah,
like,
man.
How do you?
It's just like 100.
How
of them.
Is the camera not shaking?
I know.
The laughter of the crew.
So good. So then after that, then Bloom visits Cross, in that scene that we were talking about on the stairs, and it's just a very sweet scene. And the way he played it, like up and down the stairs, is really interesting. It's just enough to like shake it up, I think.
Yeah, in that you know that they don't have anything planned, and he's just finding any excuse to, like, continue the conversation with her.
You having some carrots there?
Yeah. Some snack, yeah. It's just, I mean, you kind of relate as a – to all – you've been in that position where you're trying to keep the conversation going, keep the night going, keep the date, like, one more little something or another.
Uh-huh.
Did he have anything planned for us? No.
Right. You know? And they take their walk, and it's like – I don't know. It's – You root for them, I think,
mm-hmm.
even though, like, you don't see what goes bad. Like, she references it, her dead husband has more creativity and zeal or whatever than he does in his whole body and his one fingernail than Herman does. But you don't see any of that happening.
Yeah.
Like, you don't see it go bad.
Well, and he's married.
Well.
But then, you know, the wife, I guess, has her pool boy guy.
Brought a tuna fish and a peanut butter sandwich.
Yeah.
Another time when Max is a kid, one of a few, is when he's expelled and there's that one shot of him crying in the office.
Yeah.
That's just very short, but just super like wrecks you.
Yeah.
If you love Max.
Yeah, I think so. And you can't imagine that he's not going to be at Rushmore. Like, that is everything
right.
to him.
Everything.
So how could they do that to, you know, like, give him one last shot?
It's the worst possible offense. Like, I don't think he thought it would happen.
Yeah.
And he ends up at Grover Cleveland, which is where it kind of starts the second act where he meets Margaret Yang.
Yeah.
Who is a physician now, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She went to Brown and then she went to University of Chicago Med School.
Oh, my gosh.
And she majored in biology at Brown. And I was like, oh, that's why she doesn't act anymore.
Yeah.
Because she's doing great.
Yeah, she's doing all right. So he asks her to take her glasses off.
Huh? Yeah, that's such a great scene.
Doesn't Rocky do that to his, to?
Oh,
yeah, he does that same
to Talia Shire.
Yeah, Talia Shire. He asks her to take her glasses off.
Oh, I never thought about that. Interesting. Yeah, there. I mean, she's so great as Margaret Yang. What's I have her name in here? Sarah Tanaka.
Yeah,
got to shout her out as well as. Maybe my favorite character in the movie is Dirk.
Yeah.
Mason Gamble.
Truce! He called Truce!
That little, like, squeaky kid voice is so cute. And then Stephen McColl as Magnus is awesome, too.
So Dirk, what's the actor's name?
Mason Gamble. He played Richie Rich, which I didn't see. So everyone was like, oh, yeah, it was Richie Rich. I'm like, no, that's Dirk to me.
Yeah, I know. I didn't realize it either, but evidently that – Wes Anderson had an issue with it. He didn't want, like, a famous actor kid.
Yeah, because he had, you know.
Just played Richie Rich.
Yeah, it's like,
huge at the time.
It was a big deal, I think.
Yeah.
But God, Dirk was so good. When he spits on the car.
Yeah. Something about that.
Friends like you, who needs friends?
is the title of the music at that time.
Yeah, on the score.
You know, and I've listened to that soundtrack so much and used the songs, and I never really realized they were the titles were lines from the movie.
Yeah, from those scenes. The great Mark Mothersbaugh.
I had I was at a party one night, and Mark Mothersbaugh was on the other side of a FaceTime video. This is like – it wasn't FaceTime. It was like iChat video then. And so you stood in line to chat with him.
Really?
It was weird party, and you like went over there, and he was talking to you and doing sound and music to whatever your conversation was.
It was
very strange.
What kind of party was this?
I don't know, and I probably – you know, it was like you had 30 seconds or a minute to chat with him. And so it was a very strange thing. But that was my
– Did you brush with Mark Mothersbaugh?
Yeah, except for stealing his music for every pitch video that I've done.
Well, everyone's done that. You're certainly not the only one. But then Max goes back and sees Miss Cross. I miss Rushmore. I miss the seasons.
Yeah.
So great. Another, you know, just acting like an adult. But the funny thing with the kid stuff, though, is like their view of sexuality is like hand jobs.
I know.
Which is such a 15-year-old boy thing. It's not like – which is sweet and sort of innocent. They're not saying like, oh, did you bang her? You know, try to have sex with her?
Yeah.
Like they're just like – they're at hand job level.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's – and, you know, I wanted to watch this movie and I was like, well, can my daughter watch it? She's 9 years old, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I read the, like, hand jobs, fingering, hand jobs.
Sure.
I was like, I don't remember that. And then you're just like, oh, shit, they're talking about, you know, like it's
– probably can't – not yet.
Yeah, not yet. So Adele stop listening to this podcast right now?
But it is interesting with his sexuality, because in that scene I mentioned, when she finally like confronts him, it's brutal.
Yeah.
But necessary.
And, you know, you there's that 1 second where you almost feel like he's going to, I don't want to say overpower her, but just like force himself.
Well, he grabs her head.
Yeah. And she, you know, she just pushes. I mean, when you're watching the movie, you're just like, oh shit.
Yeah.
This is going to go very bad.
Yeah.
If this goes
uncomfortable.
Yeah. So the fact that she just pushes him down and he falls and jumps right back up, you know, you're like,
it's maybe the best like fall I've seen in movies. It was so like, there was something about it. The way he just slips on those boxes and pops up.
And do you do that take again and he does the same thing?
I don't know, man.
Or is that the one time?
I wonder about that
stuff. I can't imagine that was choreographed.
No.
You know, but
it looks so real, you know. So the hand job thing is planted, though, with leads to his complications with Dirk. Like every relationship, again, he destroys by his actions, by his selfish actions.
Yeah.
And each one has to be resolved. Of course, he resolves with Dirk in like the sweetest way ever.
Yeah.
In the barbershop.
Yeah.
And Dirk brings him the Christmas present.
No. Is he, you know, and I mean, all that happened because he wanted to Magnus, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because like he's trying to prove himself a man to.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like.
All he's doing in the movie is trying to prove himself to be more than he is.
Yeah.
Whether it's a big director or like a developer, an aquarium builder.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And Max's mother.
Yeah.
Who wasn't she the woman in Devil's Advocate? Was she
Who, Max's mother or Bill Murray's wife?
No, neither. Dirk's mother.
Oh, Dirk's mom.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Is she in Devil's Advocate?
I don't know. I don't think I ever saw Devil's Advocate all the way through.
I'm a fan of man. That's my favorite line.
I'm a phantom man?
I'm a fan of man. It's the devil. I'm a fan of man.
You always did a great Pacino. I love it. So then we kind of spin into later in that second act, and this is when we get Bad Max, when he sort of flips, and another one of the great montages is with The Who for a quick one while he's away.
Yeah.
When all the sabotages that start with – well, it starts with Bill Murray going into the hotel. One of the great lines, he goes, "And sir, how long are you going to be staying here?" "Indefinitely, I'm being sued for divorce." Like the trick of moving, sort of like in Tannenbaum's when someone moves into a hotel. It's such like a rich guy thing to do.
Yeah, with all the suitcases and the bellhops back there.
Yeah. You know, it's like, I'm going to order room service every night and someone's going to make my fucking bed every morning.
It's not that bad for Mr. Bloom.
But that montage is so great.
Yeah. And that was the first time I remember hearing that song. Like, I don't think I'm familiar with that song before.
No, that's a deep Who cut for sure.
And just from then on, it's just, you know, the emotion of him when he comes out of the elevator.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got the box and he just takes his gum and he sticks it on the wall. And
that great slow-mo shot.
It's perfect. It's so perfect. Like, it's just, you know, who thought about putting that gum on the wall there? Like, why did you, you know?
Yeah.
Those little decisions that you make that stick with us 20-something years, you know, how many years
later? Yeah, there's so many little cherries on top of the scenes. I had it written down. It was after the scene where Dirk spits on the car and, you know, with Friends Like You, Who Needs Friends. Mm-hmm. That scene could have ended right there, but it adds that little cherry on top, if you remember. He goes back and Ronnie and Donnie keep locking the door.
Oh, God, yes, that's it.
And Bill Murray is just in a fucking rage.
He just wants
to murder them.
They're just cracking up and their faces like just
– But like they didn't need to shoot that, you know. Yeah. That had nothing to do with really the story, but it's those little bitty things that like I think great directors and Wes Anderson does especially. They just like enrich it, you know.
Yeah. And you know, I think that you think about the edit of a movie.
Yeah.
And how it comes together and –
What you lose.
As a filmmaker, but there are scenes that you will cut, but you want to just shoot. I don't have time to shoot that whole scene, but I need to shoot this microphone moving from one side of the room to the other.
Right.
Because that's going to give me that emotional breath, or it's going to give me that cleanse that happens. And we needed that laugh at that point. You know?
Right.
We needed something ridiculous to happen. And the fact that Wes and Owen thought about that ahead of time.
Yeah.
You know, that the audience is going to need this, like, breath of just like, you know, to move forward. It's just fantastic.
Well, and it's just another example, too, of Bill Murray is just being controlled by these children at every turn, whether it's Dirk threatening him or Max or his fucking – I never imagined I'd have sons like these. Another one of the great lines.
Well, and that also reminds me of him in Lost in Translation when he's looking at the carpet swatches.
Yes.
You know, and she's like, do you like the blah, blah, blah red one or the other
one?
Such
a great, seemingly mundane thing.
And Bill Murray just makes you feel like I could see where he got to this point in his life.
Yeah.
You know, like I could see he had everything going great. He is a super successful person in all these movies. But yet he just lets the world defeat him and lets the world beat him down slowly, you know, moment by moment to where his little shithead kids are locking the door at him, you know, out of his Bentley, you know. It's
like, I think he even said that where's this quote about being in this movie and why he did it? Because you get the feeling like that there's so much Bill Murray and all this stuff. Oh, he says here, he said when he read the script, he said, I thought it was about for this character, it was about the struggle for him to retain civility and kindness in the face of extraordinary pain. And I felt a lot of that in my life.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's like, I think that's who Bill Murray is.
Yeah.
That's why he crashes weddings and like, you know?
Yeah.
I think he is sad.
Yeah.
He's a sad clown.
Yeah. And I mean, I know people who have run into him in Charleston through the years. And my friends of my wife, when they were having a baby, he brought them a gift, you know?
Really?
Just like, they restore his furniture.
Wow.
You know, that's their relationship. But yet he still brought a gift because he wanted them to like him, you know, or something.
That's so cool that he lives in Charleston too.
Yeah.
I know we're going to run into him one day there. So basically after the barber, I'm a barber son scene, this is when Dirk comes by and that sort of kickstarts the last third of this film where he starts having to repair all these relationships.
Yeah.
And Dirk's is first, and then Herman's is next, and that's when they meet up in the elevator, that great scene in the hospital elevator, which you know is so much Bill Murray, like, improv-ing.
Yeah, he tucks the beer and shoves it between the sheets.
Yeah, shoving everything between the sheets.
Oh, my gosh.
And when the elevator door opens, he just plays it so perfect. He just kind of stands there with a cigarette in his mouth and sort of looks around. Then it shuts again, and he sticks the can back under the sheet.
Oh, my gosh.
What does he say? I've been a little depressed lately.
Yeah.
But that scene has the sort of the crux of the film or the relationship triangle, I guess, for lack of a better word, as Bill Murray says, she's in love with a dead guy anyway. And that's sort of the crux. Like neither he nor Max can have her.
Yeah. Right. So they both not only thought they had a shot, they both sacrificed everything at that time for her. And, you know, what she got out of Max was companionship or, you know.
Yeah, someone that reminded her of her husband, I think.
Yeah. And then what she got out of Bloom was, you know, just whatever made her feel good at the time. But neither was a real option. And so many times, you know, people in society realize that they're, you know, they see something that they think is an opportunity that they build to be way more than it is because that's the way we want it to be.
Right.
But in reality, it was never an option.
You know? No.
I mean, the delusion.
Certainly for Max.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot about the delusions that we make as people to make us feel like either feel better about ourselves or feel like there is hope.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Yeah.
Is it, you know.
But they end with hope. And, you know, we're not finishing up, but, you know, we end with a hopeful note that he and Miss Cross will be together.
Yeah.
But it's not over the top.
Yeah.
You know, they sit together at the play and they're kind to one another and they had that great talk during intermission. And I think that's all you need.
Yeah.
Is a little bit of hope there, you know?
Yeah.
Because you don't see it go bad. You don't see why it's bad.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the very ending. Was that, it was a slow motion shot. What was it? it was one of the, it was a shot that starts in real time and then goes to slow motion.
Oh yeah, they ramp the camera.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is the same way they ended Bottle Rocket, where Dignan is walking in the jail.
Yeah,
and it's like a normal shot, and then uh-huh. it kind of ramps into the slow motion.
It's I think kinda, it's the same in Tannenbaum's too.
I don't remember.
It's the cemetery scene when they all leave the gravestone and they shut the gate that frames up Tannenbaum's like in the iron wrought iron.
Wow.
Dead center of the screen, of course.
Yeah, and you have to do a lot to shoot these scenes in, you know, fully in slow motion and then ramp it down. Plus, you're doing dialogue in that tone. You know, it's just.
What's your thought on Wes Anderson's like one trick pony thing? Like, I want him just to keep making these movies as they are for till the end of time. I don't need to see him do anything else. But he's getting knocked a bit for it here and there. I've seen.
Well, I mean, if I want to see a different kind of movie, I'll go see a different kind of movie.
Yeah.
If I want to see a Wes Anderson movie, you know, when I want lobster, I go to Red Lobster.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
No, it's true.
I mean, you know, I think that he's, Mr. Fox was his stretch of doing something completely different.
Yeah,
but it's
that's
still,
true.
The timing and the tone and the character developments were all similar.
I love it.
Yeah.
I don't need to see him do other things.
Right. I mean, even his American Express commercials are fantastic, you know?
They are great. I saw the one with Schwartzman. I haven't seen a ton of them, but that one was great.
The big one where he gets – where it ends and he's on the lift.
Yeah, where he was the director or whatever.
And the doves.
Yeah.
Or the pigeons, whatever they were.
I saw this morning – I was looking up I haven't watched the MTV Movie Awards since, you know, I was a kid, but – after this movie, they did the next year at the Movie Awards, they did the Max Fisher Players did reenactments of all the movies.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
It is so awesome. It's like Truman Show and Out of Sight. I can't remember what else was out that year.
Wow.
But it's the whole gang. It's Margaret Yang and Dirk and all of them. It's really, really cool.
I need to go back and watch that.
Yeah, it's great.
Out of Sight is a great movie too, by the way.
Oh, I fucking love that movie.
Out of Sight is a really good one.
Love it. So Max tries again. The bike crash scene where he totally fully manipulates her into getting into the bedroom.
Yeah.
And he still tries to kiss her. And this is when it gets like legit creepy because she doesn't allow it, but she's like stays close up on him in bed.
Yeah.
And especially like these days, it's like, oh boy.
Yeah. I mean, and just the, you know, it's past desperate attempt with him. It's,
yeah.
You know, crazy.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's out of hand at that point.
I'm going to put, you know, fake blood on my head and get in bed, you know.
He pops in the tape.
Yeah.
I love the end of that scene, though, where she's like, I need to show you the door. And he's like, I'll just go back out the window. Another time when he's a 15-year-old.
Oh.
But then things start to pick up. And then we get that great, like, last bit when he's starting with the kite flying scene in the remote plane with Margaret Yang. That's when we hear that great music cue from Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
Everything's changed in his attitude, and you hear the very important words, take dictation, please.
Yeah.
And Dirk is just like, you can see how excited he is that he's got Max back.
Yeah.
You know? Like he's refound himself.
And Margaret Yang becomes like the coolest. I mean, she's...
Yeah, she's the muse.
Yeah. She's flying a remote control plane.
Well, it's funny. What makes him really, really fall for her is when everything turns is when she says that she faked the results of her science experiment.
Yes.
He's like, what do you mean? She's like, it didn't work.
Yeah.
It didn't work, so I faked it. And that's when he goes, oh, like there's something else to her.
That's awesome. You know, to – like I just love the flaws in all these people, you know, and just even Margaret Yang has this, not just a flaw, but, you know.
A big one.
Yeah.
She like faked and won a competition. I saw that he initially had her having a wooden finger because she got it blown off in a lab experiment.
Yeah.
But then he brought that back for Tannenbaum's because, what's her name? Margot had a wooden finger.
Yeah.
It's just a funny Wes Anderson thing. Like, oh, I didn't get my wooden finger there.
Yeah.
I'll put it in the next movie.
And I remember early like blocking out like the first movie or commercial I'd done or something. Somebody was just like, this is not your only movie. It's just your first movie. You don't have to put everything in.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, I'm sure that's tough.
We need steady cams.
Yeah.
We need this. And I
that's the instinct.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know if you're ever going to get to do it again.
Sure.
So then he starts repairing his relationship with Bill Murray and we get that great One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Herman comes to the barbershop and he offers him up one of the two pins mm-hmm. to wear. I'll take punctuality.
Yeah.
And the scene where he meets Bert Fisher is just like so good.
Yeah.
Like it makes me want to cry when I see that scene now. Because it's all right there, man. He like the second he realizes this is Max's dad.
Yeah.
Like it all kind of clicks in his head. Like that's what's going on here.
Yeah. Take that aim on the rich ones.
Yeah.
You know, he did all his life, you know? So he's been doing that. And now he realizes like, oh shit, I was talking to this kid.
Yeah. You know? And he just like what Bill Murray does with his face in that scene in that 4 seconds is just so great. When you see that realization and then he warms his mm-hmm. face up and like shakes his hand.
Yeah.
And it's just so awesome. Fucking love that scene. Unbelievable. So he cleans him up, and that's when he invigorates him. And, you know, they both got a little pep in their step after that scene,
yeah.
which they both needed. They needed to find each other. And then you get the last montage, which is that silly scene to Oyoko.
Yeah.
They're, like, exercising with the steel pipes and stuff.
Is that when they do the bunny hops on the bike?
Yeah, it's just so goofy.
Yeah.
I love it, though. I'm like, why not, you know?
Yeah.
It was so playful.
And the sound, like, who decided that they were going to play Oyoko for that?
I know. In the middle of the night.
Yeah.
It's such a good song. I mean, all the music needle drops are just so perfect.
So it's a love song, and they're having this, like, comeback montage. Is that, you know, is it the love of two humans coming together, or is it just like, it's just a cute song? I mean, sometimes you like read too far into.
Right, like the lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Versus just like, it just makes me feel good.
Yeah, I think both. Yeah. It's a song about, you know, John wrote about loving someone. I think it totally is both.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the lyrics matter in this case. And then finally we get the play. We get that great tracking shot down the line of people like mm-hmm. sitting down for the play with just like a fucking 100 extras.
Yeah.
And then the play itself is just like the funnest part is me thinking like Wes Anderson got to do that play.
I know. Like I mean, just the idea of like what would I have done if I had unlimited funds as a kid to make a play to impress all my friends. Like I'm not trying to impress my peers now. How would I have impressed my friends?
Right.
In when I was 15.
Yeah.
That's cool to think about. You know.
Heaven and hell. Well, he repairs his relationship with Mangus or Magnus. Like all of them, it really goes character to character.
The flame throwing scenes and the
You know,
sorry.
No, it's great with Dirk.
Yeah.
But he had repaired a scene with his dad in the scene where he introduces Herman to him. Mm-hmm. Like that's the only time you see Max really smiling and being warm with his father, and really proud of him.
Right.
It's important, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They like an audience needed to see that. I think.
Yeah.
You know.
Still don't forgive him for being such a dick to his dad, but.
No, I mean I'm with you there for sure. And then you get the reunion of Herman and Cross during the intermission, which is really just sort of perfectly played.
Yeah.
And then the Heaven and Hell cotillion, which finishes out the movie, the post. It's like the most elaborate rap party of a high school play ever.
Oh, my gosh. It's just like not beating a dead horse, but just like, no, let's go one step further.
Yeah.
You know, it's the official
– Yeah.
The yes and that we say in improv. Uh-huh. It's like he yes anded everything. Like not only, you know, when you have a great art department and a great, you know, you say, hey, I just, you know, I need you to build me a cotillion for this final scene.
Right.
And the art department says, we can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, we're going to put the best ever.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like if a Hollywood movie, like that's what they would do for their rap party.
Yeah.
Is like totally set deck it out.
Yeah. So silly.
And, you know, it ends in such a great way. Like everyone it has that great tracking shot from person to person. And Bill Murray, you know, he finally realizes he's got a girlfriend and he admits that. Mm-hmm. And they're switching dance partners. And you get that great last shot. I had one of the stuff you should know, listeners, is an artist, a pencil artist. And he wrote me and he said, hey, I like to do movie stills and just pick one and I'll do one for you. And I thought, and I was like, that last shot of Rushmore.
Oh, wow.
And I'll have to show it next time you're over at the house. I'll have to show it to you. He did this great widescreen pencil drawing of of he and Mrs. Cross, like, chest to chest.
Oh, wow.
For that dance. It's awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I'm going to get it framed. It's really cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. Such a great movie. I'm looking at my trivia to see if there was anything else. Oh, that was – Rushmore was Wes Anderson's real high school.
Yeah.
Like, he shot at his high school
right.
in Houston, which is kind of cool.
And the public school that they filmed at was just across the street from the private. So you had this, like, these elite kids, like, across the street from normal kids, you know?
Right.
It's just like,
yeah, that's the ultimate, like, across the tracks insult.
Yeah.
All right, dude. Well, we finish with five questions.
Okay.
What's the first movie you remember seeing in a theater?
I think it was High Anxiety.
Oh, Mel Brooks?
I think so. Oh. I remember being taken to that movie when I was too young, and I don't remember anything about it,
mm-hmm.
but that's all I remember. I remember seeing that in the theater.
Okay.
Like, I don't know. I don't remember
the year. It's funny because mine was Blazing Saddles. I went to the drive-in with my parents, and I sat, and that's all, you know, I don't remember it.
Yeah. I don't know if I remember if there was something before that, but for some reason, like, I remember being in Florida as a kid seeing that movie. It's probably rated R or something stupid.
Did your parents take you?
No. I don't think I've ever been to the movies with my parents.
Really?
Yeah. I cannot remember ever going to the movies with my parents.
Well, actually, now that you mentioned, I don't know if I ever did. Because my dad wasn't into it. I talk about that all the time on the show. He was not into movies.
I used to go a lot with Joey Dorlek.
Movies. Yeah, I didn't go to the movies much with my parents either.
Yeah.
But we were the latchkey generation.
You and I saw Barton Fink together in the theater.
That was big.
Golly, that was a life changer.
It was very big.
Yep.
I think we saw Miller's Crossing together too, didn't we?
I think so.
For the first time. What is the first R-rated movie that you saw? Do you remember? At home or anywhere?
Caddyshack, probably.
All right.
Also, Car Wash.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I remember Car Wash.
Yeah. I remember those distinctly.
Yeah. Because your parents, your mom and dad weren't, like, super strict.
No.
They've always been pretty cool.
Yeah. They were cool about stuff like that.
Like, they trusted you guys.
Yeah.
I feel like.
And I remember we had a cable box that you would open up, and if you move the little electronic things just right, then you got all the channels, so.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk with various guys in here of our generation about trying to get squiggly boobs on the TV.
Yeah.
Boobs? Were those boobs?
Yeah.
Such a big deal. What movie – oh, no, wait. This one – all right, let's do will you walk out of a bad movie?
I don't think so.
Probably not anymore, right?
No. I go to movies so rarely now.
Yeah, same.
That I'm gonna go.
Right. Like, you know it's a good movie.
Yeah. Will I pause one? Will I stop watching one at home? Yeah.
Yeah, that counts.
Yeah.
That's the modern version of this question. So you'll bail on a movie if you think it sucks.
Yeah.
But there was something about, like, being in the theater and, like, I'm getting up and I'm walking out.
Right.
That's sort of a statement.
I don't think I've ever done that.
Yeah. All right. All right. This one I tailored to the guest. Let me think here. Or maybe what's your favorite editing in a film that comes to mind?
I mean, you know, things that changed editing for me would have been like Snatch, you know, or Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, or Goodfellas had an interesting style. I mean, I think this movie's got great editing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you have these like movies where – the style was just so absurd that it just changed the way that people saw editing and storytelling for the next 5 years. So,
yeah.
I think it was just more influential than Love It.
Yeah.
And I think Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels is probably one of the most revolutionary editing styles.
Yeah.
Yeah,
people really like jumped on that Guy Ritchie style for a while there.
Yeah.
For sure. And then finally, Movie Going 101, what is your movie rituals? Where do you sit? What do you eat?
I now have to pee a lot. So I limit the amount of Coca-Cola.
Sure.
But no, I mean, you know, I think if I can have popcorn and some sort of chocolate crunchy something that I'll mix together in there and a Coke sitting right in the middle, I am – I usually start off every movie very frustrated because inevitably whoever I'm going with doesn't want to be there as early as I do.
Okay.
Like, I want to get there at plenty of time to sit and relax. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, if we're running late, I'm not going to get in line for a soda. Like,
right.
I need to get in the seat and I need to get comfortable
yeah,
and
I
need
to
know
way.
That I'm there.
It's all about that seat.
Yeah. So, but now you reserve your seat.
That's great.
Right?
Yeah.
I could not go to one of those, like, we're going to eat food behind you movie theaters.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
It drives me mad to hear. I've got a real problem hearing people crunch food stuff like that.
Misophonia?
That's what that's called. Yes. Yeah. Like, I cannot focus on anything but that popcorn eater behind me.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You should go to matinees then.
Yes. Well, I just wait and I buy them and I watch them at home, you know.
Right.
And my lovely wife, Mita, who is fantastic and smart and beautiful.
Yeah.
Likes to pause and chat about the movie.
Yeah, Emily talks a lot too.
Yeah.
And we and love boy, them. Emily and Mita together, there's a lot of chatting.
Yeah.
I'm going to get Mita in here too. That'll be fun.
She would love – she's really smart.
Yeah.
I know like she she's smart.
Yeah, we'll have Mita in here.
Yeah.
All right, dude.
All right,
thanks.
Thank you.
That was a lot of fun.
Good to see you. Can we have band practice this week?
Let's do it.
All right, bye.
All right, folks. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I hope there was not too much inside baseball, as they say, with two old buddies kind of sitting around talking to each other in their shorthand. We tried to make it as accessible as possible for the world at large, and I think we did okay. Rushmore, great film. It was so much fun to watch it again after a little bit of a break. Movie I've seen so many times, but it had been a minute. And it was so much fun to sit down and talk with Jim about that and just giggle with him. And I wish you guys could have seen us in here because there was a lot off mic gestures and nods. And it's one of those things when you're friends with someone for 35 years or so, there's that shorthand that you have. We can be in band practice and I can look at Jim playing the drums while I'm singing and we'll just lock eyes and just start fucking laughing at each other for no reason at all. That's just sort of how it is with us. He's the best. I'm going to get his wife, the lovely Mita Issa, in here soon. She's wonderful as well. And keep this friends and family thing going. I'm having a lot of fun with these. So I hope you enjoyed our chat on Rushmore. Let us know if we missed something that was important to you and we'll talk about it on a mini crush. But I hope you dug that. That was a lot of fun. Until next time, why don't you save Latin? Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.